This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT Knoxville. 6 minutes past 1 o'clock, and I'm your host, Matt Schaefer-Powell. As we mentioned at the top of the show, a majority of Americans support the death penalty, but it's not much of a majority. Executions are actually a rarity these days, and as controversy swirls around exonerations, execution methods, and the availability of lethal injection drugs, Americans continue to lose their appetite for capital punishment. There are currently 71 men and one woman on death row in Tennessee. As of right now, the chance that they'll die of disease or old age outweighs the chance that they'll be executed. And it doesn't appear as if that's going to change in the near future. On today's dialogue, we're going to stop and take a look at capital punishment in 2016. The history, the ethics, the practicality of it. Our guests are Stephen Kissinger, an attorney who represents inmates on Tennessee's death row, and Penny White, a professor of law at the University of Tennessee and a former state Supreme Court justice. Penny, welcome to Dialogue, and Stephen, welcome back to Dialogue.
Thank you, Matt.
Can we hear real quickly sort of a brief history of capital punishment in Tennessee?
Well, I like to describe Tennessee's relationship with the death penalty as on again, off again. And so if we look at it in about three eras, the first era, clearly, at its founding, Tennessee supported the death penalty as reflected in three state constitutions that referred to capital offenses. But even as early as 1807, we had a governor, John Sevier, who was urging abolition of capital punishment in Tennessee. He wasn't successful, and it remained a part of our culture in the state. With the invention of the electric chair, Tennessee joined other states in the Union, got its own electric chair, and moved executions out of the county public square, where they had been quite a spectacle, to the state center at the state prison. And that was in the early 1900s. But even with the building of Tennessee's own electric chair, our appetite for the death penalty was fairly sparse in the early 1900s. 1930s was the century, or the decade rather, in which we had the most executions in Tennessee, with 47. And if you look at the people who were being executed between the 30s and the 50s, you will see that a large number of those were African Americans, and a large number of those were being executed for a crime, rape, which is no longer a capital offense. So that second era of the death penalty, kind of the post-electric chair era, saw more executions in Tennessee, but yet still some, a different level than you were seeing in other southern states at the time. The modern era, which I'll start with 1960, began with another execution of an African-American man for rape in 1960, and then executions ground to a halt in Tennessee. We actually did not execute anyone else for 40 years. And what happened between 1960 and 2000, which is of note, a few things happened. First off, obviously, the United States Supreme Court in Furman v. Georgia in 1972 questioned and paused death penalties until states rejiggered their statutes. Tennessee tried three times, and on the third attempt in 1977, passed a new statute which the state Supreme Court upheld. So in 1977, we were primed to begin executing individuals again. But between that period of time, not only had public sentiment changed, we also had two governors, both Frank Clement and Ray Blanton, who did not have an appetite for capital punishment. Governor Clement tried to abolish the death penalty, and when he failed, released most inmates from death row in Tennessee. And actually, from 1972 until 1978, we had no one on the row in the state of Tennessee.
But it's not as if there wasn't a lot of discussion about it. It's just that we weren't having any executions, and as you mentioned, nobody on death row for a while.
We had a governor who was stopping it for a while. But then just fast forward to where we are today. In 1990, a new Tennessee Supreme Court was asked once again to declare the state statutory provision unconstitutional. And by a vote of 3-2, the state Supreme Court declined, upholding Tennessee's statute. Now, from that point, 1990 until today, 2016, we have seen 6 executions in the state of Tennessee. And we have seen all of those, with the exception of one, by lethal injection.
And the last was, I think, 2009, is that right? Yeah, I think so. Anyway.
So that's where we are today.
Yeah. What's changed? We talked a little bit at the very beginning of the show about this this Pew Research poll, and I'll probably bring this up a couple times during the show. But in the last 20 years, support for the death penalty in the U.S., and we don't have a more recent poll here in Tennessee, at least not since 2011, but in the U.S., it's dropped more than 20 percentage points in the last 20 years. That strikes me as particularly significant. What's changed over the last 20 years as far as the conversation surrounding the death penalty?
I think a couple of things have happened over the past 20 years. I think there's been increasing concerns in two areas. One is that, at least in Tennessee, the state seems to be having problems carrying out the sentence in a correct and constitutional manner, which is one area. I think the other one, and one which is perhaps more of public concern, is that I believe that people have decreasing confidence in the reliability of the justice system. Here in Tennessee, we've had scores of inmates who have had death sentences vacated and life sentences imposed in their place. But we've also had at least a couple of cases where the Tennessee courts have determined that the person who sat on death row was actually innocent of the crime that they were convicted of. I think those kind of concerns span the entire country, because in the other states, similar things are happening. Courts are determining that people have been convicted and sentenced to death for crimes that they didn't commit.
How does DNA play into this? Because, you know, say 40, 50 years ago, we didn't have DNA evidence that can now be used to and has been used to exonerate some people.
Well, I think DNA has been a big step in terms of locating or identifying wrongful convictions. But the other thing that DNA has revealed is that not every case has DNA evidence in it. Most cases don't. Very few do. But the fact that we have DNA showing that wrongful convictions are occurring is, again, giving people pause. They may say, yes, DNA has cleared this one inmate, but they go, but the system, if the system worked, he wouldn't have been convicted in the first place. And who else would have been exonerated if there had been DNA in their case? If the system isn't working, it can't be relied upon to produce a reliable result.
I agree with Steve, and gratefully, because of people like Steve, even when the state courts get it wrong and affirm convictions, the federal courts, sometimes removed from the political realities of having to stand for election as a judge, turn over those death sentences years after they've been affirmed by state courts. But I think a byproduct of both DNA and the public's somewhat lack of confidence in the system is the sentencing alternatives that modern statutes have provided. So people are more comfortable with a life without parole sentence, particularly when they know that a state's life without parole sentence means life without parole. So that sentencing alternative, combined with a lack of confidence in the outcome of a death case, I think has also added to a decreased appetite, if you will, for capital punishment.
Do you think it's easier for a prosecutor, when you're talking about people's the way people are affected by the death penalty, do you think it's easier for a prosecutor to ask a jury for life without parole than it is to have them consider the death penalty?
I think it depends on the prosecutor.
Well, I'm curious about that, too. If I'm probably jumping ahead of myself a little bit here, because there are a lot of issues that I still want to talk about, including lethal injection and everything. But I'm wondering if we're seeing fewer prosecutors asking for the death penalty now than we would have, say, 20, 25 years ago?
I think there's the decision whether to seek death has a very large political component to it. Mm-hmm. And the ability of a prosecutor to be able to go to family members and say, this person will never see the light of day. They will spend the rest of their life in a cage. And to say it with confidence takes a certain amount of that pressure off. Now, obviously, people who are the victim of violent crimes suffer a great deal of pain, almost an immeasurable amount of pain that I really believe that everyone needs to fully understand and fully sympathize. But if they don't have that concern that this person is going to harm someone else, it removes at least a little bit of the burden. And I think that's something prosecutors are able to offer when we have an option like life without parole, which we didn't always have in Tennessee.
What are sodium thiopental and pentobarbital, and why are they important to our public perception of execution and the death penalty?
Well, I mean, they're both drugs. They're both barbiturates. They work in slightly different ways. From a legal standpoint, the difference between the two is that sodium thiopental cannot be legally imported to use for the purpose of executions in the United States.
It used to be, right?
It used to be. Well, let me take that. Let me walk that back just a little bit. It was never legal to import it for use in executions.
Okay.
It was being imported for use in executions, and it was also being manufactured domestically, which is a completely different issue. What happened to sodium thiopental is that the domestic manufacturers of sodium thiopental wished, as a business decision, not to be involved in the business of executions. Mm-hmm. They felt it was not good for their company, it was not good for their shareholders, and they ceased making it.
And they were the only manufacturer within the U.S.
Right. And it got down to the point where there's only one manufacturer, and they made a decision to quit manufacturing it. What happened after that is that the states turned to foreign manufacturers who also FDA approved. But when they turned to those manufacturers, they also, just as a business decision, were not interested in providing sodium thiopental for use in executions. Following that, they turned to manufacturers in India and other places that were not FDA approved, that were basically making drugs that could not be imported into the U.S., and tried to obtain drugs from them. After a certain period of time where they were, I hate to use the term, but were getting away with doing this illegal importation, the FDA stepped in and basically told them that they couldn't continue to violate the federal drug laws and seized the state's supply of sodium thiopental.
So suddenly you have, not just in Tennessee, but you have states all around the country that use lethal injection, finding that there's the shortage, that they don't have the drugs. Even if they wanted to, they couldn't execute with lethal injection because they don't have the drugs available.
Right, and this spread to other drugs as well, including pentobarbital. The simple fact of the matter is that drug manufacturers do not want to be involved in executions, and they're making that decision and they're sticking by it. So the states have been turning to other methods to try and find drugs so they can continue with this lethal injection process, which has become quite a favorite among the states because it's on the surface a very peaceful process, which underneath and unknown to the observers is actually quite torturous.
We're going to take a quick break here on Dialogue. Our guests are former Tennessee Supreme Court Justice Penny White and Stephen Kissinger of the Federal Defender Services of Eastern Tennessee. If you want to participate in the conversation, you can tweet us at WUOTFM. You can send us a Facebook message or fill out that little handy little box on our homepage, WUOT.org. And as always, you can call us. We're going to open up the phone lines now. You can call us at 974-5050. That's 974-5050. And this is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Matt Schaefer-Powell, and I'm joined by Stephen Kissinger, a Knoxville-based attorney who has represented several death row inmates in the appeals process, and Penny White, a University of Tennessee law professor, former member of the state Supreme Court. If you have questions or comments, you can catch us on Twitter or on Facebook. And if you go to our webpage, there's a neat little question box you can fill out, and we'll do our best to get your question to our guests. And of course, you can always call us at 974-5050. During the break, we were just talking about how there has been a legislative shift in this whole death penalty conversation quite recently regarding electrocution. And Penny, could you bring us up to date on that?
Yes. Before 2014, the condemned had the choice in Tennessee whether to die by lethal injection or electrocution. We did have one inmate choose electrocution after lethal injection was available, but for the most part, most states, including Tennessee, was using lethal injection. In 2014, our legislature passed a statute that basically said if we get in a position of not having the drugs available for our lethal injection protocol, then we will mandate electrocution. So we're the only state to have taken that strong a stance in favor of capital punishment with these recent developments concerning the drug availability.
Strictly speaking, from a technical standpoint or technological standpoint, electrocution strikes me as something that's it's a very old technology. Is it applicable in 2016?
Well, we've certainly had a large number of electrocutions that have turned out poorly. And honestly, I think that the appetite for execution dwindled because of some of those. The aspects of seeing what happens, I mean, individuals literally catching on fire, turned some people against capital punishment. Lethal injection, as Steve said, is seen as a much more peaceful way to go, much more appealing. So the technology still exists. I think was it 2009, Steve, when Daryl Holt died in the electric chair in Tennessee?
I don't know if it was that recently, but fairly recent.
7 or 9.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So it has been used in the last decade anyway.
Mm-hmm. We're going to go to the phones, 974-5050, 974-5050. And Jim is calling from Knoxville. Jim, welcome to Dialogue.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have a question about evidence as far as – I better turn off my radio here.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Evidence – yeah. Evidence as far as what would be how high a wall that is needed so that someone could actually have that death penalty carried out. You can't help but notice that Mosaic law is the basis for a lot of our laws. And I noticed in the book of Deuteronomy, it says, let no one be put to death except on the basis of 2 or 3 witnesses. That seems like a pretty good high wall and a decent protection. What I was wondering was, how many people have been put to death in the state of Tennessee on the basis of a single witness, which obviously is very flimsy, you know, the kind of thing where, hey, I saw so-and-so leaving the house, and, you know, that's enough for conviction. How bad was it, and could that even happen today?
Yeah, go ahead. Penny, thanks for the call, Jim.
Well, sure. In Tennessee and in most states since Furman, the death penalty is a bifurcated proceeding, or a capital trial is a bifurcated proceeding. And so the question that Jim poses has to
do... What does that mean?
A two-stage proceeding.
Okay.
So in the first stage, the question is whether the person is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of a capital offense. And those offenses are limited to murder or felony murder. And so the question he poses really has to do with that stage. So how much proof is necessary? necessary to find somebody guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not an equation. It's a matter of degree, and it is a matter of 12 jurors being convinced beyond a reasonable doubt. But even after that decision is made, and I would like to just as an aside mention that Tennessee was the first state to say that jurors, citizens, would have the discretion to make death penalty decisions rather than mandating a death sentence. So in that second, what we call the penalty phase, the jurors have to make two decisions. First, they have to decide, has the state proven an aggravating circumstance beyond a reasonable doubt? And those are enumerated, and they're what you might expect. There's a whole host of them. But even after that, because the United States Supreme Court in the Eighth Amendment requires an individualized determination, the jury has to look at what's called mitigating circumstances and has to then determine in Tennessee beyond a reasonable doubt that the aggravating circumstances, if any, outweigh the mitigating circumstances. So it's not an equation. It is a matter of a jury, again, of 12 citizens going through the stages and applying the law as I've described.
Are you going to find something like that in most of the other 49 states?
There are some differences. Texas is dramatically different. The jurors respond to particular questions there about the future dangerousness of the offender. But many states, many of the 31 states who still have capital punishment on the books, follow Tennessee's model.
Penny, I wanted to talk to you for just a moment about your retention vote.
Lack of retention, we call it in my family.
Yeah, that's right. If you could kind of bring us up to speed, and the reason I'm bringing this up, because it was very much the attitudes about the death penalty had very much to do with the fact that you are no longer on the Supreme Court.
Well, it's ancient history, but I'm the only justice to not be retained as a member of the Tennessee Supreme Court. It happened in 1996. The public belief of the reason was because of my vote on a particular capital case and because of what was perceived as my view on capital punishment. In reality, it's the only capital case I ever sat on as an appellate judge, but the powers that took me out as a justice were very crafty and smart in knowing that the death penalty was a very emotive issue for Tennesseans. But in reality, it was a surrogate. It was a way to frighten the public, as the death penalty is often used in judicial elections as a way to frighten the public, the way to convince the public that the death system has shut down and it's the responsibility or it's been because of a particular justice. I mean, the irony is, as I said in the history, we didn't execute anyone from 1960 until 1996, but I was, at that time in history, the block. I was perceived as the person who was stopping capital punishment. Mm-hmm. And it's actually nothing about the death penalty is comical, but it's somewhat comical that that politicians could so convince the public. Very quickly, the case involved just what we were talking about with Jim, whether or not the state had proven beyond a reasonable doubt an aggravating circumstance. And in that case, the aggravating circumstance was the heinous, atrocious, and cruelty aggravator. So the issue was, had the state met the legislative definition of cruelty? That definition is very different from what you and I would think if we were talking to our children about what is cruel. Mm-hmm. And that disconnect is what enabled political forces, I think, to ignite the public and ended up in my not being retained on the Supreme Court.
When you hear me talking about, again, I bring up the Pew poll, but there have been other polls who have also confirmed that Americans don't have the appetite for capital punishment that they did 20 years ago. Do you ever think about your situation in that context that, you know, if people felt differently then, I might be on the Supreme Court right now?
Sometimes. Yeah. Let's be honest, sometimes.
But you don't spend a whole lot of time.
No, yeah, no, yeah. I'm pretty happy.
Yeah, well, great. Stephen, I was wondering if you could, I mean, you've certainly represented a lot of folks on death row, and I'm wondering if you could kind of give us a glimpse into what death row is or what it looks like.
Well, I mean, it isn't what a lot of people think. The inmates on death row spend basically all but I believe, 1 hour a day in their cells. They get one shower a week. So it's basically how I described before, which is they live in a cage. It's not that they're out playing ping pong or that kind of thing. Their life is one of confinement. The other thing is that in addition to being confined that time, they're confined with that knowledge that the next day or the next week, someone may come and kill them and carry out the sentence. So it's a situation where it's certainly not like a country club or anything like that. The punishment is very severe, even absent the carrying out of the execution. In the case of inmates who have valid claims, claims are important, claims of innocence, claims regarding the imposition of the death penalty, it becomes an extremely frustrating position because the courts move very slow. People think, well, the courts move slow and it's not fair to the victims. Well, to people who deserve relief, it's not fair to them either. And it does take. I mean, in the case of Paul House, who is a client of mine, Paul House spent 25 years on death row for a crime he didn't commit. And the fact that it took that long, that so many courts said, no, we don't, you don't get a new trial, you don't get, we don't care, you know, we've had a trial, we're done with it, and over and over and over again, and all those times thinking, yes, someday, because I know I didn't do it, someday I'll be set free, and for that to take a quarter of a century is obviously a very stressful situation.
Do you ever have clients who, maybe not a situation like Paul House, where he was exonerated and, like you said, spent 25 years on death row for a crime he didn't commit, but maybe one that's a little bit, the conviction is a little bit more clear-cut. Do you ever have clients who say, you know what, I just want to get this over with. I don't want to appeal this. I don't, just, you know, I'm at peace, maybe, with the idea that I will die.
I mean, I personally have not had clients like that. I've had clients that have said that they're not interested in fighting the penalty aspect of it, that they believe that they did not deserve to be convicted, and that their trial was unfair, or that their attorneys didn't represent them the way they deserved to be represented. And that's what they want emphasized. Now, it's easy. I mean, sometimes you think, well, the reason they're doing that is because they want people to look at them more sympathetically because they care about their trial. But the fact of the matter is what they really care about is some of the same things that we should all care about, which is what they care about is having a process that is fair, a process that is fair and just, and that's what they're fighting for.
974-5050 is the number to call. 974-5050 if you have a question for either of our guests, Dr. Penny White or Stephen Kissinger. And of course, we're talking about the death penalty today. Taking a look at the death penalty in the year 2016, what are some of the issues that surround that conversation, and how has the conversation changed over, say, the last 20 years or so? Let's go to the phones now. Jim has been holding patiently from West Knoxville. Jim, welcome to Dialogue.
Yes. Technically, we can do all these things. That's technically is never the problem. Mink farms have been putting hundreds of mink to death to sell the fur with laughing gas or nitrogen, and there is no pain. You can. It's just a routine thing, and so that's not that. That's just a problem that they create. Now, it is a political issue. It's a right-wing, left-wing issue, conservative-liberal issue, and one peculiarity of it: abortion, late-term abortion, is stopping a beating heart. Execution is stopping a beating heart. The people that don't want to execute people are perfectly all right with a late-term abortion. So their whole argument doesn't really make a whole bunch of sense. And then on that public attitudes toward things, we don't live with a public attitudes except over a long period of time, and we certainly should not. We don't make policy by public opinion. We live under a rule of law. Just one more, one of the big points one of the talk show ladies made makes is that societies that won't execute the assassin of a United States senator, 1968 Bob Kennedy, are people, they don't really believe in themselves. Well, they're kind of wondering, maybe it's not so bad to execute a senator. What the heck? So he's been sitting in jail for a period. And then a bunch of, on NPR and a radio station, too, a bunch of in Louisiana, they said, I wish they'd execute me. I'm sick of this. And so that's not an argument either.
Jim, I'm going to jump in here because I want to make sure some other people have the opportunity. Thank you for your call. I want to make sure other people have the opportunity to talk on the show as well. Jim makes a bunch of different points there. I'd like, if you have any of them that you'd like to respond to.
I mean, I think the only thing, when I hear Jim talk, I think I hear something that perhaps a lot of people are convinced of, people on both sides of this issue, which is that the death penalty has become far less about justice or about carrying out a penal objective, about protecting society or about reducing crime or about all these other things that I think everyone's concerned about, and more about politics and, you know, who's for this and who's for that and, you know, who's on the right side and who should we vote for and those kind of things. And when that becomes the deciding factor in whether we're taking another person's life, I think our system's broken. I think it's lost its way because we're no longer concerned about making society safe. We're concerned about political opportunism.
And one of the things the points that Jim made also is that public attitudes don't necessarily play here. I think he said that we live under the rule of law, but by the same token, public attitudes, and probably I'm responding to it more than asking a response from you, but public attitudes help shape what happens from a legal standpoint because we elect people to go to legislatures, we elect people to go to Congress, they can make laws, we elect presidents who can appoint Supreme Court justices and those sorts of things as well.
Sure. And you know, one of the things throughout our history that has been touted, but which is just not true, is that we have a sound penological purpose for capital punishment. So for years, it was argued that the death penalty was a deterrent. It's certainly a specific deterrent against the individual who is executed, but it was argued for years that it was a general deterrent. And criminologists and academics have plainly established that that simply isn't true. So as Steve says, when we start thinking about what is a basis for a humane and modern country to punish, and in this particular situation, there really is nothing but vengeance in the execution of another human being.
We're going to take a quick break here on Dialogue. Our guests are former Tennessee Supreme Court Justice Penny White and Stephen Kissinger of Federal Defender Services of Eastern Tennessee. If you want to participate in the conversation, you can tweet us at WUOTFM, send us a Facebook message, or fill out the handy little box on our homepage. That's at WUOT.org. And as always, you can call us at 974-5050, 974-5050. And this is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Matt Schaefer-Powell. I'm joined by Stephen Kissinger, a Knoxville-based attorney who has represented several death row inmates in the appeals process, and Penny White, University of Tennessee law professor and a former member of the state Supreme Court. If you have questions or comments, you can catch us on Twitter or on Facebook. If you go to our webpage, there's a neat little question box you can fill out, and we'll do our best to get your question to our guests. And of course, you can just call us. The number is 974-5050. I mentioned that box on our website, and Wesley from Knoxville submitted his question on our website. And here's the question I would pose to both of our guests. Is it fair to use the tax dollars of the poor to keep convicted murderers clothed and fed? They need to feed their children, after all. You probably, I mean, it's not a new argument. Maybe the addition to the socioeconomic reference there might be something we haven't heard quite as much.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. We are using the tax dollars of us all to convict all sorts and to house all sorts of people convicted of crime, the majority of whom are poor. So As long as we have a nation in which we choose to incarcerate anyone for the commission of a criminal offense, we're going to have to fund it. And the criminal justice system does cost a lot of dollars, not only for treating those who have been convicted humanely, but for providing representation, for providing police services and prosecutorial services, which whose dollars are far more in terms of expenditures than the defense side. So I think that's just one of the costs of being a developed nation with a criminal justice system.
You know, right now there's a play running at the Clarence Brown Theater. It's called A Lesson Before Dying, and it's kind of an examination of the role that socioeconomics plays in capital punishment. What kind of a role does it play? And I guess specifically I'm talking about the people who are condemned to death row. They tend to be of a lower socioeconomic status.
I would venture a guess, and let Steve correct me, that there's not a person of those 71 on death row in Tennessee now, nor was there one of the 100 who were on death row in 1996 who had a hired lawyer. I bet they were all indigent, all requiring court-appointed counsel and resources, because those are the people who are charged with capital murder.
I mean, that's certainly pretty close. if there were any, it's very few. There's two great distinguishing characteristics of people on death row. One is the disproportionate distribution of the death penalty according to race. But the other is the one that Justice White just mentioned, which is the issue of people who are poor. Overwhelmingly, it's people who are poor. Overwhelmingly, it's people without the resources to fight back against a really very well-funded prosecution.
974-5050 is the number for you to call if you have a question or comment for us here on WUOT Dialogue. We're going to go to Becca, who is calling from West Knoxville. Becca, welcome to Dialogue. Are you there,
Matt,
Becca?
This is can you hear me?
Yeah, sure can.
Great. Matt, actually, this is Becca Hoviger, a reporter with WBIR.
Oh, hey, Becca.
Hi there. I thought I'd call in because your timing's actually perfect, and thank you, Stephen and Penny, for addressing this important issue. Today, I happen to be coming back from covering a plea agreement where a woman pleaded guilty to the first-degree murder of an ex-boyfriend. That was in June of 2014 in Cumberland County. And my question for you, I was talking with the district attorney general afterward, and he said this plea agreement was life in prison, 51 years minimum. And I'm wondering if, given the trend perhaps away from the death penalty in the state of Tennessee, if we are seeing fewer and fewer district attorney generals seeking the death penalty in first-degree murder cases.
Great. Thank you very much, Becca, for the question.
I don't have the statistics on that statewide. I would imagine the answer is yes, but I do have two statistics that play into that. One is that in 2015, nationwide, there were 45 death sentences. Compare that to 1998, when there were 295 sentences. So there are two things that could generate that decrease. One is that prosecutors are seeking the death sentence less frequently, and two is that jurors are giving the death sentence less frequently. So it seems to me that that may be an indirect answer to Becca's question.
Let's go to Riv, who is calling from Knoxville. Riv, welcome to Dialogue.
Yes, hello. I had a question here about what I hear is a lot of politically safe jargon going on and not really mentioning the issue of the core morality of, say, 20 years ago, I mean, how much we've expanded our cognitive horizons of what is sensible, what is not sensible, what is backward, what is forward. And I think that plays a big part in the reciprocation of capital punishment. Could that be touched on, perhaps?
Well, great question, Riff. Thank you.
One thing from the Gallup 2014 poll that struck me, I'll just say this, and then I'll pass the question to Steve, give him more time to comment on it. But in that 2014 poll, gauging the death penalty in the country, people were asked why they felt the way they felt. And 40% of those who opposed capital punishment or who favored a life without parole sentence gave morality grounds or religious reasons for their opinion. So I think he's exactly right. That is certainly affecting the shift in attitude.
Right. And I mean, I agree with that. In a recent lethal injection case, the Glossop case, there was a concurrence by Justice Scalia. And in that, the late justice, and in that concurrence, he lamented the fact that the death penalty was being looked at in terms of a standard that the Supreme Court had stated 50 years before called the evolving standards of decency, mm-hmm. which is how does the death penalty fit in the concept of who we are as a human, as human beings, and who we are as a civilized people. His position was that as long as it's fair, what our morality demands is irrelevant. That as long as it's fair, the Constitution, as long as it's carried out fairly, as long as the process itself is fair, it doesn't matter whether it's moral. It doesn't matter, you know, what people's collective judgment is or what their sense of decency is. That there is only one issue. I think it's notable because that was a concurring opinion for a reason. It's a concurring opinion because a majority of the courts simply doesn't accept that the evolving standards of decency are relevant. And as we proceed, as it becomes opposition gets stronger and stronger, I do think that we are moving toward a point where we simply say that this is simply incompatible with living in a civilized society, the continued imposition of capital punishment.
And I would guess, I didn't bring either of you on the show today to necessarily look at precedents by the Supreme Court, but I would guess that the U.S. Supreme Court, if you went back far enough, you could find plenty of examples where previous rulings may have been reflected in some way to changing standards of decency, I would guess.
Certainly.
Yeah. Penny, you work at the UT Law School. You're a professor there, and so you have the opportunity to meet and talk and have salient conversations with law school students. And I'm wondering if you see any of this that we're talking about as far as death penalty, that there may be a shift going on with younger people.
Well, in a bit of a biased view, I'm the interim director of the UT Legal Clinic, and there we engage our students in learning how to practice law by representing poor people in the criminal courts, and in one of our clinics, poor people who may be serving life or life without parole sentences in our innocence clinic. So I am speaking with like-minded students mm-hmm. quite a bit, and there is a tremendous energy around assuring fair process, around assuring that the indictment of lawyers who don't provide effective lawyering to their clients, that be a thing of the past. These are students who are engaged in wanting to make sure that they are always doing everything possible to represent their client the same way a corporate lawyer would his or her client. So I think there is quite a bit of energy and enthusiasm for increasing the number of the awareness of the issues with capital punishment going forward. Just yesterday, we had a phenomenal speaker at the College of Law, Jonathan Rapping, who is the founder of a program which helps lawyers be better lawyers. And he spoke a lot on the issue of changing the criminal justice narrative, changing the narrative in which poor people are victimized even further by poor representation in the courts. So there was a standing room only crowd there, and the students were really involved in what Jonathan Rapping had to say and really took the torch. I think we'll take the torch forward to do much about it.
Let's go to one more call. I think we can fit one more call into the hour. This is John calling from Knoxville. John, thank you for waiting.
Well, you're quite welcome, and thank you for taking my call. To what extent is the death penalty self-evoking in that the government provides an example of violence that then evokes violence in the population? So that not only do we have the death penalty as a result of violent behavior, but to what extent does does the violent behavior result from the death penalty? We're in the periods when Tennessee did not have the death penalty or had it suspended, did the rates of crime that for which it would have been the punishment, did they drop? And also looking at other states, like I think Wisconsin early on did away with capital punishment. But is it an example that causes it to be evoked?
Well, thank you very much for the question, John.
A couple quick points. Southern states have the highest murder rate, yet they have the most prevalent death penalty use. So in terms of violence begetting violence, that might be an anecdotal response. And I would also comment, the caller talked a little bit about Tennessee's history. One of the facts I omitted earlier, in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, when we were executing the most people in Tennessee, was also the time in which there was a call for the revival of the KKK, there was great racial injustice. And so certainly there is support for the idea that this government condoning of violence is inconsistent with the kind of society which we would like to create, like to have.
I'd like to direct this question to both of you, because I'm sure in sort of cocktail party conversations, this comes up quite a bit. I'm going to use the example of LaMarcus Davidson, who was convicted and sentenced to death in the killings of Shannon Christian, Christopher Newsom in 2007. Anyone who knows anything about that particular case knows that it was a brutal, heinous, horrific crime. If somebody comes up to you and says, "Okay, now isn't that an example where somebody does deserve the death penalty?" How do you respond to that?
The way I respond to it is personal. I wouldn't respond to it as a professional or an academic, although I probably could muster a professional or academic response. But I respond to it as personal. Everybody, in my personal opinion, as Steve Bright likes to say, is better than the worst thing they ever did. I believe that a life without parole sentence is severe punishment. It's fitting punishment, and that would be my cocktail party or church pew response.
This is a question also submitted to our website, WUOT.org. Once an inmate, and this comes from Michael in Knoxville, once an inmate has been put to death, his or her condition is irreversible, and at that point, beyond any kind of appeal. How does that square with the Eighth Amendment's probation against cruel and unusual punishment? Prohibition is the word I was looking for, not probation.
You know, the Supreme Court has taken an easy way out on the constitutionality of capital punishment. Because of the use of the word capital in the Fifth Amendment, which says all capital offenses, similar to the Tennessee Constitution, the U.S. Supreme Court says that means that the founders assumed there would be capital offenses, okay? So therefore, their jiggling of what is cruel and unusual punishment presupposes that there must be a way to execute that is not cruel and inhumane. So that's a very, very basic explanation. The Eighth Amendment is informed by the Fifth Amendment's inclusion of the phrase capital offenses. Therefore, it's not cruel and inhumane in the position of the U.S. Supreme Court to date to in some way execute. Is that fair, Steve, for a late description?
I think that's a fair description of the way the court has described it. I mean, simply looking at the plain language of the Constitution, it's a very strained kind of argument, mm-hmm. but it's one which at least a majority of the former court adhered to. The idea that the Eighth Amendment is somehow limited by the Fifth or vice versa really has no basis in the text itself, I think simply in a desire of particular jurists to reach a particular outcome.
Last question I have for both of you. Do you foresee a day when capital punishment is no longer legal in Tennessee? Or is this just simply, this public opinion we're talking about, simply a swing of the pendulum?
Oh, I'm going to go on record here as being an optimist. I see that day.
Steve?
I mean, I think we see that day perhaps from two angles. One, from a political side, where the people are simply unwilling to continue to support it, and also from the point of adherence to the intent of the founding fathers in the when they created the Constitution of the United States.
Well, this has been an absolutely fascinating conversation. Thank you so much. We are out of time here on Dialogue. I want to thank our guests, Penny White and Stephen Kissinger. Thank you both for coming out today. Thanks also to Greg Hill, who ran the board and handled the phones today. Thanks to Brandon Hollingsworth for keeping an eye on social media. And thank you for listening and calling and sending your questions. If you missed the show or you just want to hear it again, we should have it up on our webpage in the next hour or so. Just go to WUOT.org. Dialogue is a production of 91.9 FM WUOT Knoxville, WUOT HD1 Knoxville, and WUOT.org, a listener-supported service of the University of Tennessee.